Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, as part of our ongoing series, Government from the Inside, we speak with San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon. What does it take to reduce crime and make San Francisco safer? For tonight's guest, the city's first Latino DA and the first police chief in the nation to hold the post, the answer lies in holding offenders accountable while avoiding costly and often ineffective punishment. To that end, his office has launched a number of initiatives, from alternative sentencing to neighborhood courts, focused on rehabilitation, restorative justice, and victim advocacy. And the DA has also trained an eye on crime prevention, inducing mobile phone manufacturers to develop so-called kill switches, developing new strategies to keep at-risk kids in school, and using technology to prevent and predict crime. How successful have these initiatives been? What new programs are in the offing? And what challenges lie ahead for DA Gascon's model of progressive justice? Joining me in the studio then is George Gascon. He was appointed by Mayor Gavin Newsom in January of 2011, replacing Kamala Harris, and was elected by voters the following November. Prior to becoming District Attorney of San Francisco, he was the chief of police here, the chief of police in Mesa, Arizona, and assistant chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. DA Gascon is a board member of the Council of State Governments Justice Center, a graduate of the FBI's National Executive Institute, and is a member of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government's Executive Session on Policing and Public Safety. Welcome, George Gascon.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Good evening.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and you can call 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at klw.org, or on our Facebook page. So, DA Gascon, I wanted to start with a thumbnail sketch of your assessment of crime and safety in San Francisco.
Well, you know, San Francisco is a very safe city. We're fortunate that we live in a place where the level of crime in general is not very high. We're also fortunate to live in a city that, generally speaking, we have not been as impacted as other communities by the economic downturn. So a lot of the social services that we have available that may not be available in other places are certainly in our toolbox in order to deal with crime. And I think we also have we're at a place where there's a wonderful opportunity to explore alternatives, and there is a high degree of tolerance for exploration and progressive thinking when it comes to public safety, and that is an area that I enjoy deeply, and frankly, that's an area that I'm very passionate about. So we have been able to do a great deal of experimentation, keeping our community safe at the same time that we have lower incarceration. For instance, we're the only urban jail in the state that actually consistently is running at about a third vacancy, and a great deal of that has to do with the way that we prosecute cases and the way that we have been handling outcomes in the prosecution of cases. You have many parts of the state that, especially post-realignment, they're having a tremendous problem with jail overcrowdiness. In our case, we have not had that. And a great deal of that has to do with the partnerships that we have here in San Francisco, you know, the work that we do with adult probation, the work that we do with many of the other community-based organizations that have services available for people that we would normally in other communities perhaps be incarcerating, but here we can work in a more progressive, restorative manner and actually have community-based supervision. You know, very globally, I think that one of the problems that has really impacted the criminal justice system and public safety for the last two decades in this country, and certainly in California, has been an unsustainable model that has included a high degree of incarceration that has become unsustainable socially and economically. Here in San Francisco, I can say with a great deal of pride that we have been able to keep our community safe and do so while we're reducing incarceration. This is not happening by accident, obviously. It happens because there are a lot of good people working together to make this possible.
So you're saying that your model that you've outlined here, which is looking towards restorative justice and really looking to new ways of understanding responses to crime, both once they've occurred and preventing them, are really setting San Francisco apart, and that there doesn't need to necessarily be a trade-off between, you know, public safety and rehabilitation.
Yeah, I would argue actually the reverse is the case. I think that when you're more focused on rehabilitation and you're more focused on evidence-based practices, you actually have an opportunity to make communities safer. If we can reduce the reoffending rate of our offender population, we're actually creating a safer community, and we're doing so at a reduced cost because the most expensive part of the criminal justice system is the cost of incarceration and the cost of prosecution. So any time that we can reduce the likelihood of someone reoffending, and we do so without having to prosecute and incarcerate that person, we're actually saving not only money, but we're saving the pain and suffering associated with victimization.
So how you said that this city is relatively tolerant to this type of progressive thinking on criminal justice. What kind of response have you gotten? Obviously, you were elected into a position that you were appointed to. So on some level, the public was in support of your point of view on this. But now that you're in office 18 months or so, how have people been responding to your brand of progressive justice? And I would break it down by saying, how have your partners in law enforcement, like the police and the sheriff's department, public defenders, how have they responded? And then how have other stakeholders in the city responded? And how have the citizens of the city responded?
You know, really well. Obviously, because I was appointed and I had been in office for a year when I got elected, people obviously had an opportunity to look at my style of running a DA's office very deeply. I was not simply a candidate wanting to be in place. I was someone that they actually got to see what I was doing. And frankly, I was, you know, I got elected by 62% of the vote. So I believe that a lot of people felt that I was bringing the right approach to the office. I have to say that within the criminal justice family, we work very well. A lot of the things that I talked about earlier wouldn't be possible if we were not working very well with everybody else. I think one of the things that is very important to recognize is that no one in this very complex system can do it alone. You need to have good policing, and you have to have progressive thinking in the way that the police department works. You obviously need to have a good, solid probation department. You have to have a good sheriff department. They have to be well-funded. We need good community organizations. And then certainly we in the prosecution side have to be, there has to be alignment in what we do with every other partner. So all these things are working in a very complex environment where, by and large, we're all seeking to have the same things, which is to have a sustainable safety, public safety model, and do so in a way that is thoughtful, that is intelligent, that deals with crime and holds people accountable, but understands that accountability is not always necessarily related to being very punitive or certainly high levels of incarceration.
And within the law enforcement community that you mentioned, were there any areas where perhaps there wasn't alignment, so to speak, with your point of view? And how did you work through that?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always going to be some points where there may be some disagreement between the parties, right? We do not live in a perfect system, and nor should we. I mean, I think that it is important for people to have a point of view, and it's important sometimes to have very robust discussions about, you know, what is the right level of intervention or what is the right level of attention by the criminal justice system in any one area. But having said that, I think that we really, by and large, have a model that others want to emulate. And we often have many people coming from other parts of the state and even other parts of the country that are looking at what we're doing, because I believe that what we're doing is working really well. And that wouldn't occur but for that cooperation and the collaboration between the, all the partners.
And so I'm curious, the in the role that you've had now for 18 months, what landscape did you step into in the district attorney's office? So let's take it even the circle even closer amongst the people that you now lead. What were they looking for, and how did has your leadership responded to what your staff have how they've wanted to see that department shift over time, and what do you feel what did you find, and where do you think the department is now?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's really been 2.5 years because it was a whole year prior to the election.
Sorry, so my math is bad.
No, that's okay. But yeah, time flies. Actually, I was telling someone that I have been there for 2 years, and they corrected me on all the circuit. And I said, "Yeah, you're right. It is 2.5 years, and it, you know, time has just absolutely been flying." But yeah, you know, within the office, I'm fortunate enough to have a really good group of people. They have been very flexible. They have been very open to trying different ways. You know, when I brought in things like the alternative sentencing planner, which is the first one in the nation where we actually hire a social worker within our office to work with our prosecutors to evaluate the circumstances of serious offenders and trying to evaluate who would be better served by different levels of intervention outside of incarceration. When we expanded and, you know, created the neighborhood core model, which was an expansion of the community core model that had been there for some years, but actually took it into a completely different level, where we were actually taking cases that we would normally prosecute and completely removing them out of the criminal justice system and putting them into this alternative model. When we started talking about creating predictive analytics in the prosecutorial world, you know, all these things were things that are new, and they require people to start thinking about their job differently, and it requires flexibility. And I have to say unequivocally that as an office, people have been very accepting and very embracing of new ideas. And frankly, they have become very creative, and they are coming up with their own stuff, and they're doing incredible things that I probably would have never thought about it before, but they took on and they started to move in that direction.
And as you heard in my introduction, this is one episode in a series on government from the inside. And I have to say that some of your colleagues at other heads of the departments of the city haven't always had the kind of welcoming that you describe. And I wonder, you know, when you think you talk about evidence-based practices how hard did you have to sell something like that? Again, law enforcement kind of used to doing things a certain particular way. How hard was it to sell a different way of doing things?
Well, you know, you have to, first of all, I think that it's very important that when you are bringing new things to the table, that you're very honest with people and that you clearly state the things that you know and the things that you don't know. I think that, you know, especially you're dealing with very smart people, you cannot just go in and just plow through them. So what I did is I tried to bring things to the table that I wanted to explore, and I was not sure, you know, how they would work, and I needed their help, right, and they needed them to embrace it. And then I brought other things to the table where I clearly knew that they would work, right, and I was very honest about distinguishing one from the other. And I think that that made a great deal of difference. The other part is that I have a very inclusive style of leadership, so I like to bring people together because I think it's important for people to feel comfortable and feel that they are valued and that they're given an opportunity to have input. You want people to own whatever you're trying to do. And, you know, I'm not here to say that it's always been smooth sailing. Again, you know, sometimes you have strong opinions and you have to respect those and you have to work through them. But in my experience, when you are inclusive and when you are thoughtful about the way that you bring things to the table, generally, you know, you're going to be much more accepted.
So let's turn now to some of those things that you mentioned in terms of initiatives. You mentioned the alternative sentencing, the neighborhood courts. There's also placing prosecutors at police precincts.
Police stations, yes.
Yes. And then there's the Sentencing Commission, which I imagine goes hand in hand with the alternative sentencing. And then you mentioned the predictive analytics. I'm very curious to hear more about that. But why don't we start with alternative sentencing? So, and if you would, as we go through these in turn, if you could help point to any evidence base that you've used to inform your initiative, that would be great. So tell us the scope of that program and what its aims are and how it's going.
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, based on years of experience and working in the criminal justice system for me and looking at what works and what doesn't work, is that I am convinced, and there is a lot of evidence out there that shows that there are many people that get incarcerated that actually, by being incarcerated, not only are you likely not to make them any better, but you're actually likely to worsen their circumstances. And there are some people that probably for a variety of reasons need to be incarcerated, but that's a very small number of people. So towards the informing of our practice in a different way, I knew that it was important to bring in somebody that had a proven track record and working as a social worker within the criminal justice system, someone that understood local gangs. And we went about hiring an alternative sentencing planner, and basically we found a young man that had been a social worker. He had been working for 10 years in gang intervention. He knew how gangs in San Francisco operate. And he also knew a lot of the service providers. And what basically we did is we went to the prosecutor and says, look, when you're having these cases where you could go either way because it's not a murder, it's not a, you know, it's not the kind of stuff that you know clearly this person is going to have to do some time, but you have these cases that are more sort of in the middle that could, they're serious, but you're unsure as to what the best outcome for this person is. Let's have our ASP do a workup on it and really let's have a different point of view come to the table before we decide how we're going to prosecute a case. So what we did with our alternative sentencing planner is basically he looks at those cases and he does a complete analysis of the individual, not the offense that the individual committed, but the individual. And there are things that we know that are evidence-based. Like, for instance, we know that someone that has a good community network, meaning they have family members, they have a job, or they have kids, they have people that are likely to support them, are more likely to react positively to a community-based supervision than people that have no one. We know that, for instance, that people that may have a mental health problem or may have a heavy drug abuse problem, sometimes the two are combined, actually may not do well at all under an incarceration setting. But if you're going to keep them outside, then you have to make sure that you find the right level of supervision and the right level of services for that person. So what we went about doing with our alternative sentencing planners, he would actually pick up the docket, he look at the person, he start analyzing, he does a little bit of research about, you know, where has this person been, and, you know, where are they at today? And then based on his experience and a lot of other knowledge that we have is, you know, try to tailor perhaps a different approach for that person and then work with the prosecutor to make sure that we can present the right case to the defense or if we actually take the case to trial, that we're seeking for the right level of sentencing. We've had already, this program has been in place now for about a year and a half, and we've already seen some great results where we've taken young people that could have gone to state prison for robbery for a long period of time, and we haven't, and we've kept them in community-based supervision, and a year later, we see the person working, we see the person with a high school diploma, we see the person regaining custody of their child, and, you know, which means that this young kid doesn't have to be in a foster care environment. And tremendous success story where we could have sent this person to state prison and probably many other places they would have gone to state prison. And the young child would have been in foster care, probably becoming a problem child himself later on. To me, that's a success story. And a lot of this is based on, you know, a lot of the studies that have been done about, you know, how do you reduce recidivism? How do you work about community-based supervision? And we sort of overlaid that over the offense and then work with the prosecutors in trying to tailor make a case that is, you know, a plan that would work well for that person.
And what happens? Do they still get a conviction on their record? How does that all work?
Well, it really depends. You know, in some cases, like in the case of the robbery, yeah, the person got a conviction because this was a serious offense. But we also work, like in our Back on Track program, where we actually, if you go through the entire process, we will work to expunge your record after you complete all the requirements of the program. So we also try to look for places where the end game would be that if you clean yourself up and you do all the things that you're supposed to do, we want to take that criminal record away from you, which will be such a great inhibitor and your ability to find employment and housing and so many other things.
And how about the reoffense rate of this group that has gone through this alternative sentencing?
So it is early. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be misleading, but certainly the early results of this young people that we're taking under this program.
Yeah, there were 700 last year about, right?
That's actually the neighborhood courts, which is a different program.
Okay. I have my numbers off.
The alternative sentencing planner has looked at about 200 cases.
Okay.
And
200 cases.
And he's taking many of those cases. On some of the cases, he's basically said, look, I can't. This person has way too many problems. There is not enough in the community for him. And, you know, and unfortunately, we're not ready for him today. But of the cases that he has come up with alternatives to incarceration, although very early on, we're seeing some really good results. And the perfect example was a young man that I was telling you, where he's, you know, he's now back with his, you know, his daughter. He's working. He's got his high school diploma. He's actually attended drug rehabilitation programs. He's not using drugs at the level that he was using them before. Like him, we have several others that are really good examples of how this can work.
Any concern from in your office or at other levels of city government about liability to the city for not having pursued a more traditional sentencing program? Should someone go on to reoffend?
Yeah, and you know, and this is really where the rubber meets the road for prosecutors, right? Prosecutors generally are very risk adverse. And the easiest thing that a prosecutor can do is, you know, throw the proverbial book at someone, right? You can send someone to prison for as long as you can. If the court releases them early, or if they, then you can say, well, look, I washed my hands. I did everything that I could. The problem with that approach is that if you look at our recidivism rate, statewide, right around 70%, San Francisco previously about 78%, if people, everything that you're touching is failing at such a high rate, what you're doing is not safe at all, right? You are actually making it riskier for the community because all you're doing is you're getting these people in and out of the system and they're reoffending and they're re-victimizing many other people. So I would argue that what we're doing is actually safer. We're taking an educated approach. Clearly, there's always risk in everything that we do. There is risk whether we send you to prison or whether we keep you out. Right. And people say, well, how can it be risky to send someone to prison? Well, most of the people that we send to prison are coming back out.
And reoffending.
And reoffending. And they come back out and they're worse than when they went in because now they have actually gone through a training process about perhaps how to become a better criminal. So that is a risk. So I would argue that actually if we can reduce the likelihood of reoffending by doing community-based programs where we can and where it makes sense. And by the way, I don't want to lead people to believe that we're putting murders back out on the street. That's not what we're doing. But there are a lot of people that are in between. And those are the people that we're concentrating on.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're in conversation with San Francisco's District Attorney, George Gascon. And we invite you, our listeners, to dial in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment on KLW.org, or on our Facebook page. So let's move next to actually, tell us a little bit about the Sentencing Commission. So how is that dovetail with the alternative sentencing, or is that a totally separate initiative?
Right. Well, it is connected. All the things are actually connected very, you know, if you're looking at it at the high level, the 30, 40,000 feet above the ground. The Sentencing Commission is an effort that we legislatively created where we're basically trying to research not only locally but, you know, nationally and other places and look for best practices in terms of sentencing practices. What are the things that work? What are the things that do not work? Why do they work? Why don't they work? And actually have a more validated way of looking at the way that we seek sentencing in our county. Frankly, this should happen at the state level. You know, one of the handicaps, we have the only sentencing commission, by the way, in the state of California, and there has been attempts before to have one at the state level, and they have failed for a variety of reasons, probably none of them very good other than just politics. But we really should be having a sentencing commission at the state level that actually gets into penal code reform. But given that we don't have that tool, what I wanted to do was at least at the local level, start to create a process where all the partners in the criminal justice system, as well as community members, work together to analyze what are the things that we could be doing differently in order to make our community safe, and to do so in a way that is going to be economically and socially more thoughtful than what we have done in the past. So the Sentencing Commission is precisely that kind of work. In fact, this week, Wednesday, we're meeting, and we actually are bringing a group that includes a public defender, a prosecutor, and a police lieutenant from the Seattle area, from King County, because we're looking at an experiment that they're doing with drugs, drug arrests, where actually the officers in this pilot area, they have the option of, instead of booking an individual into the local jail and seeking to go through the normal prosecution process, actually taking the person directly into a community-based organization for services when the offense is driven by drug addiction or drug use, and completely taking it out of the criminal structure, and then having the health and the social professionals work with this individual at the same time that the officers are still keeping track of what's going on and the prosecutor. I mean, everybody gets to know what's going on. But you're taking these people, you're diverting them even before there's even any discussion of filing a criminal case. And they're having some very good results. In the pilot area, actually, drug open-air market drug sales have gone down when compared to other parts of the county. Their crime has gone down at about the same rate or even slightly higher than other parts of the county. So they have something that appears to have some intriguing results. And although it's very early on and they have not done any validation studies yet, it looks very promising. So I wanted to explore that because one of the things that drives, not necessarily in San Francisco, by the way, but one of the things that drives incarceration rates around the state and around the country is drug arrests, right? Here in San Francisco, we have done a really good job of diverting a lot of stuff, sending to drug courts and doing other alternatives to the actual incarceration. But I believe that we can do better. And, you know, I think that this may be a model that could work here very well. So that's something that we're exploring. And we're having a public defender, a prosecutor, and a police lieutenant actually come and present to our sentencing commission this week. We're looking at many other things as well. But that's a good example of the kind of stuff that we're doing. Yeah. And the more broader level, we're looking at how do we prime the discussion for penal code reform. California's prime for creating a commission level work at the state level where we actually would reform the penal code. And we move away from punishment and into rehabilitation as a philosophy behind our criminal justice system. We moved away from rehabilitation probably a little over two decades ago, and I believe that we have paid the price for that. And we need to go back and start rethinking about the way that we approach the criminal justice system.
So to take a moment, or to divert a moment, to the realignment program, which is diverting certain offenses to remanding them to county jails as opposed to prisons, right? And then having certain nonviolent offenders complete their parole as probation at the county level. How do you see realignment as putting pressure on other municipalities besides San Francisco to start to look at some of the initiatives you've been describing in order to manage the influx of inmates that would otherwise come to the counties to have to put in jails?
Well, you know, there's no question that realignment is altering the way that we do business at the state level. The question is, you know, there are 58 counties, and there are probably 58 different ways of dealing with realignment. You know, one extreme, you got people that are talking about building more jails so that, you know, basically replacing the earlier model of incarceration at the state level and supplanting that by creating a model at the county level. And then on the other extreme, perhaps like San Francisco, where, you know, we're actually talking about split sentencing, we're actually continuing to lower our incarceration at the local level.
What's split sentencing?
Yeah, so split sentencing is where, for instance, and that's one of the tools that the realignment provided for us, where we can take an individual that under the old system, let's say it was a non-residential burglary, they could have gone maybe to state prison for, say, 3 years, depending on what their prior record was. Now they would go to local county jail for 3 years because, by the way, realignment hasn't altered the number of years that you can send somebody to a custody setting. It just simply says if you want to put them in custody rather than send them to the state, you're going to have to keep them locally. But what one of the tools that realignment has provided is to say, by the way, that person that was going to go to prison for 3 years and now you can send them to county jail for 3 years, you could say, you know what, I want to do maybe 6 months in county jail, and I want to do 2.5 years of community-based supervision, or I want to do 1.5 years of one and 1.5 years of the other. So it gives you the alternative to actually split the sentence where technically you're doing your time, but you're really doing your time in a community-based supervision. And some people will say, well, isn't that like probation? Mm-hmm. And it is and it isn't. It's a different animal. It was created by realignment. It's an area where, for instance, we're using it very, very liberally, and we're seeing some very good results.
I want to shift for a moment to another question of unintended consequences. How do you see San Francisco's movement towards progressive justice and sentencing alternatives? How do you see that potentially shifting patterns of crime from counties that surround San Francisco into San Francisco? If you could potentially conduct a crime in San Francisco and get a different kind of sentencing, would that shift a pattern from all of neighboring counties, you think?
Well, I mean, certainly that's one of the concerns that some people have raised. We have not necessarily seen that. You know, our crime has remained fairly steady. There's a little bit of an increase. And I think that's probably more associated. And by the way, it's been a region-wide. And I think that a lot of it had to do with the significant reductions in the public safety budgets, not only in San Francisco but other counties, where you have had tremendous reductions in police forces. And I believe that has had an impact. But when you look at our homicide rate or you look at generally our crime, especially our violent crime, we have not seen an increase. So we're doing this stuff. We're now into it a good 1.5 years of this model, and we haven't necessarily seen an increase. So I don't think that we're really having a situation where we're attracting somebody else's criminal. Often, by the way, a lot of our crime does come from other communities, but that preceded all these problems. You know, we're an attractive center for people to come, a lot of tourism. There's a lot of things that make San Francisco a very attractive place, and, you know, sometimes crime does travel as far as that attractiveness, but we certainly haven't seen a significant increase in our crime that we can say, boy, this is related to the way that we're doing business. Furthermore, you know, you will hear often people blaming realignment for the spike in crime in some parts of the state. And I would argue that, first of all, there really is no evidence to prove that at this point. It's too early on to have sufficient data to say, hey, realignment is increasing our crime. More importantly, when you look at the San Francisco example, or you go to L.A., the city of L.A., you know, the largest city in the state, and L.A. continues to see crime reductions today under realignment, it's very hard to argue that realignment is causing crime to increase. Certainly, there is no scientific evidence to prove that. Now, perhaps 2 or 3 years down the line, we may be sitting back here and say, well, you know, there were some unintended consequences. But anyone that tells you realignment is causing an increase in crime today is saying so out of emotional discussions. There's really no data to support that.
415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight with San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon here on City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station. I'm Joseph Pache. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at KALW.org, or on our Facebook page. So let's go to a caller, George from San Francisco. Welcome to the program. Hello, George.
Hi.
Oh, sorry, Zach is what I meant. Sorry.
Right. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Inspector, or Mr. Gascon, I heard something shocking today on Gil Gross's show regarding the murder that just took place at O'Farrell and Larkin. You know, 15 to 18 bullets, one murder. And I understand this was between Honduran gangs that openly sell crack at that intersection. And I understand that that intersection is outside the boundaries of the Tenderloin police station, and those crack dealers know that. And it, that area is supposedly covered by Northern Station out on Fillmore at Turk. You know, what do we need to do to see that the boundaries are readjusted?
Well, in sec, I want to make sure that I follow your question. Do you believe that the murder was a result of this area not being policed by the Tenderloin police officers as opposed to the Northern police officers?
Well, that's what was implied today on the show that I listened to on Gil Gross.
Well, I apologize because I did not hear the show, so obviously I don't have a full context. But I, you know, a San Francisco police officer is equally trained and equally supervised in any of the 10 districts. I'm not sure that I understand why the boundaries would make any difference. You know, we obviously have, you know, we have, like any other major urban center, are going to have some level of gang activity, some level of street sales, and sometimes, you know, gang members will fight and dispute territory. But the San Francisco Police Department in general has done very well this year. In fact, our homicide rates are significantly lower than they were last year. And our homicide rates have been down since I came as a chief of police in 2009. In fact, our homicide rates in 2009 went down to levels that would have been comparable to the late 1950s, early 1960s in San Francisco. And they have continued to stay there. And currently this year, they're down from the previous year. So overall, our murder rate is down and significantly down. Having said that, any murder is one too many murdered. I don't know the relationship between station boundaries. So I'm not, I feel unable to answer your question.
Okay. All right. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for your call. 415-841-4134. feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at klw.org or on our Facebook page. I'm going to go next to an anonymous email here saying, what was the rationale for DA Gascon's dismissal of approximately 630 domestic violence cases or on or around his first day in office? Why change course so drastically given his commitment to prosecute crimes of violence against women and girls?
I'm not sure what this person has gotten this information, but certainly that's not accurate. We have not actually made any changes in our posture. To the contrary, we have actually added people to our domestic violence unit, and we have done very well in the way that we handle domestic violence. And approximately a year ago, there were some questions about the difference between the way that we handle domestic violence in other counties. And we actually went out and looked at the difference between our county and other counties. And we found out that actually not only our prosecution rates compare very favorably with those neighboring counties, but so did our conviction rates. As a matter of fact, what we found is that there were some counties that would file many cases before they looked at them, and then they were dismissing the cases later. We, as a practice that preceded me, by the way, this was under Kamala Harris as well, have been more thoughtful about the cases that we actually file on, and we file on the cases that we believe that we can prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. When it comes to domestic violence, especially on the misdemeanor domestic violence arena, those cases are very difficult to prove because generally you're talking about cases where there are no visible injuries, and you have the victim and you have the offender, and it's the word of one against the other. And often the victims will recant or maybe not even report the crime. Many times the crime is actually reported by a neighbor. And those cases are extremely difficult to prosecute and certainly extremely difficult to obtain a conviction. Whereas in the felony cases, you generally have injuries, you have medical reports, you have a great deal of evidence. Thankfully, we do well. We do not have a large number of felony domestic violence cases here. But having said all of that, I can tell you that we did a deep analysis of our work in this area because we wanted to make sure that if there was anything that we could learn from any neighboring counties or anywhere else, that we wanted to go out and learn it. And we found that we were doing very well, but we were terribly understaffed. And that was corrected earlier this year. Thankfully, we got the help of the mayor's office and the board of supervisors. We got additional funding, and now we're staffed to the level that we should be. But I don't know where this person got the message that we dismissed 600 cases that were not dismissed previously. That's totally inaccurate.
415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go next to Rajiv in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I was very happy to hear about the decriminalization of marijuana that happened recently in the states of Washington and Colorado. I wanted to get your take about how you felt about the priority of pursuing drug offenses in your department, and also in general, what do you think about decriminalizing marijuana in San Francisco?
Well, let me start by telling you that we actually have a very progressive way of looking at drug offenses in general. Cases get diverted here many, many times. We generally look for alternatives to incarceration and alternatives to prosecution when it comes to drug cases, especially when you're talking about drugs for personal use. When we're talking about possession for sales, larger quantities is a different story. Having said that, I believe that drug use is better handled as a health problem as opposed to a problem that can be handled by the criminal justice system. So I am a strong believer in using health-related solutions to the use of drugs and illegal drugs. I think that that would be a better way to approach the problem. And that's why, for instance, I mentioned earlier that we're inviting, and I invited the folks from the King County in Washington to come in and talk to our sentencing commission this Wednesday, because they are piloting a program where they actually do pre-filing diversion on drug cases, and they seem to be getting some very good results.
Thanks so much, Rajiv, for your call. So let's go back to the neighborhoods where it all begins. So let's talk about the neighborhood courts and the neighborhood prosecutors. And if you could also bring in, given our Zach, our earlier caller, around gang violence, if you could use that perhaps as a case study of how the neighborhood courts, neighborhood prosecutors may be able to tackle the issue of gang violence and other features of those that you'd like to talk
about.
Yeah,
absolutely. So one of the things that I wanted to do as soon as I became district attorney when I was appointed is that I knew that in order for us to maximize our ability to prevent crime and to work effectively at the neighborhood levels, that we needed to be at the neighborhoods. You cannot do that from the Hall of Justice. And I thought it would be very important to actually put prosecutors that are working at the neighborhood level with community organizations and the local police. So what we did is we put prosecutors that are assigned 100% of their time to police stations, and their function is to go out, meet community members, work with neighborhood level organizations, assess what are the problems that the crime is causing in that particular neighborhood, and try to determine what is the best tool that they can bring to the table in conjunction with working in partnership with the police. So what we have is we have a situation where our neighborhood prosecutors are involved on a daily basis. They're working on problem solving. They're identifying problems with the community, and they're looking for solutions that may or may not involve the criminal justice system. I mean, often there are civil solutions, civil sanctions that we can use. Sometimes it's simply talking to people and using the authority of the office to modify behavior. Like if you have a business that is engaging perhaps in poor business practices, like maybe selling liquor to minors or, you know, allowing the distribution of liquor in a way that may not be necessarily what they're licensed for. Then the other piece of this program is our neighborhood courts. And our neighborhood courts are a non-judicial process where our neighborhood prosecutors actually, every day, they look at the cases that were handled by the police the night before or the day before. They identify cases that they believe is appropriate for neighborhood courts. And if they are, then with the approval of the offender is given an option. You can either go to a regular court proceeding or you can go to neighborhood courts. If they elect to go to neighborhood courts, the neighborhood courts is basically a process where you go in front of three panel members. They're non-lawyers, they're civilians, they're neighborhood people in that neighborhood. The person goes in there. The victim may go. The police department presents their report. There are no lawyers involved in the process. And the person that goes into neighborhood court, they're accepting responsibility for their behavior. And they go in, and then the victim may go and talk about what occurred, what it meant to be victimized by this person, whatever the actions were. The offender gets to say what was going on, what they did to the level that they want to. And then the panel basically comes up with sanctions that are non-criminal and non, you know, they're not involving the criminal justice system. So the sanctions could be providing restoration to the victim, maybe fixing property or providing some kind of restoration. They may be community service for people that are having problems, like an offender that maybe have problems with drug abuse or alcohol abuse or something. They could be also sent to treatment. And then once they complete the treatment, we drop the prosecution of the case, and there is no criminal record attached to that. And anything that goes on in the neighborhood court proceeding, it's all confidential. Even us as prosecutors, we don't get to hear any of this. So let's say that a person later on decides, hey, I'm not going to do what the neighborhood court is telling me. I want to go to the regular court. Basically, we start from scratch. We have no knowledge of the conversation or any of the admissions that were made in that process. We handled approximately 700 cases last year. We see a growth of this process. Has given tremendous amount of empowerment to the community, because neighbors actually get to say a great deal of what goes on in their community. Again, this program is only about a year and a half, but we're seeing some very good results. And the interesting piece of all this is that we're seeing very swift, very economically sound way of dealing with these problems. If you were going to go to a regular court for some of these offenses, this case may be hanging on for 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half. The victim may have to go to court two or three times before they actually get to testify. A neighborhood court case actually gets in front of the panel within 2 to 3 weeks from the time of the offense. The entire process, including the offender completing whatever the sanctions are, usually happens within 90 days. And it's done at a fraction of the cost of trying a case. So we're seeing early results that are very, very encouraging. And we're increasingly taking more cases, and we're actually looking how to take even more serious cases in the future.
And how are the panel members vetted, trained, and supported?
Right. So the panel members, they have to volunteer. And actually, we have a waiting list right now. We have approximately 100 panel members citywide. We got about 150 people on the waiting list. If they get accepted, they go through a training process that is done by our office and the nonprofit that we work with. And then we have a nonprofit that actually supervises what goes on in the panel to make sure that there is uniformity to what the panel does and that they stay within the parameters of neighborhood courts.
So I'm curious here to go back to the link. Do you see these two initiatives, the neighborhood prosecutors and the neighborhood courts, in any way helping to get at the issue of gang violence, which sounds perhaps out of the scope of at least the neighborhood courts, maybe not about out of the neighborhood prosecutors?
Yeah, there's absolutely a linkage, because what our neighborhood prosecutors do, let's say that we have an evolving gang problem in a particular neighborhood, they start working with the police, they start working with neighbors and figuring out what are the best ways that at that particular neighborhood, based on the problem that they're having there, what are the things that we can do that can make the best, that can have the best results. Some of these cases are going to be clearly going straight up to our gang unit and being prosecuted. But there are many other things that we can do for intervention. You know, we can take young kids and, you know, put them in our anti-truancy process. We can we can. There's a lot of intervention that we can do. We're actually now getting ready to launch by the end of the summer a similar program of restorative justice dealing with juveniles, because the program that I just mentioned is for people that are 18 and older. We're actually going to start a similar program, and it's a little different, and it has to be modified because juvenile laws are different, but we're actually going to start a restorative justice model with people under the age of 18.
And staying for a moment with the issue of gangs, what do you think is in your toolkit, or you would love to get into your toolkit as something that's going to help to address this issue in the city that has perhaps not been tried yet or not tried to the fullest extent that you'd like it to be?
Well, you know, the area that I believe over a long period of time, the most successful way of dealing with gangs is to keeping kids in school. Truancy and dropping out of high school is almost a straight line, unfortunately, for many into gang activity, criminal activity, and eventually incarceration. So one of the areas that I have been very heavily involved has been in the reduction of truancy, working with the young kids to make sure that they do well in school. We actually started a pilot program about a little over a year, actually, right here in Burton High School, where we took kids that were coming from the middle school. They already had an established record of high levels of truancy. And with parental approval, we put them into the special cohort. We've put a lot of resources and, you know, an attendance counselor. We track them. We work with both mentoring and tutoring, and we have seen some great results. And this is the kind of stuff that I personally believe over a long period of time are going to impact our gang problems more than anything else. Having said that, when we have gangs, active gangs, especially gangs that are involved in violence here in the city, and we certainly have some, like any other major urban center, we have to be very smart and very thoughtful about going after those people. And when we have people that are actually engaging in violent activity, we have to make sure that we collect the right level of evidence and we put the right level of cases together to make sure that people that need to be incapacitated are incapacitated.
So I'm curious, it's hard not to draw a connection between community policing models and this neighborhood prosecutors. How do you see the two having their own, each having their own sort of turf, so to speak, or how do you see them working together?
I actually see them working together. Frankly, this is where
we're not duplicating each other's.
We're not duplicating. People are working together. This is actually coming directly from my experience as having been in policing for so many years and understanding that prosecutors also have to be part of that process. So what our prosecutors are doing are working with the local police in their neighborhoods and working on their community policing efforts by bringing prosecution to the neighborhood and adding that other level of support to that process.
And I want to now shift a little bit from how you approach criminal justice in a way that seems very oriented towards rehabilitation and the context that the person sitting in front of you or your prosecutors, that context that person brings, to the technical work that your prosecutors are doing, this idea of the predictive analytics. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so one of the things is that drives prosecutions in this country is the fear of risk and the fear that if you do not incarcerate someone, you're going to put the community at risk. And one of the things that I found out through my experience in policing is that there are some people that clearly are very dangerous, but that's a small number of people. There are many other people that are somewhere else in between not being dangerous and being very dangerous. And the question becomes, what kind of tools can you provide a prosecutor so that they can do a quick analysis of the situation, the person that they have in front of them, and determine how should they guide their prosecution intervention and at different levels throughout the process?
Could you give us an example?
Yeah. So let's say a prosecutor comes up and, you know, you're looking at a robbery case, right? And you're looking at an individual that maybe has no prior robbery history, is 17 years of age, has a family here, has been missing school, and you have a determination to make. You know, you could prosecute this person and to the fullest extent of the law, or you can actually engage our alternative sentencing planner to go out and do a little more work and determine whether We have a good family situation, or we have somebody that would be willing to work with this young person to keep him in line, and whether we have other services that we can wrap around that person. Having a predictive analytic tool that can take some of these factors very quickly and give you a quick assessment of risk, risk of reoffending, risk of flying the jurisdiction, differentiating between risk of reoffending for violence or risk of reoffending for nonviolent offense. There are ways to actually create algorithms that, based with very limited information, can give you a response with a very high degree of probability so that then you inform your practice concerning that particular case.
So a question, follow-up question to that is, well, let's say you have two people in front of you who've committed the same crime, but they have different social support structures. You would choose one type of sentencing in one case or prosecutorial strategy in one case and another in another. Isn't that for the person, let's say, who has less social supports, isn't that sort of damning them a second time?
It depends. You know, what you're trying to do is you're trying to assess what is going to be less intrusive and yet get the results of keeping the community safe, because that's got to be your first goal. And secondly, what would be the best thing that you can do for that individual? I'll give you a perfect example. If you have a person that has no employment, has no family, and has no home, there is a lot of data that would tell you that if those three factors are present in your life, your likelihood of reoffending are very, very high. So then the question becomes, okay, what can we do? If we decide not to incarcerate the person, what are the steps that we have to do to get housing, get employment, and get a support mechanism around that person? That is the kind of stuff that with predictive analytic tools, you can actually look and see, based on the totality of the circumstances, what are the interventions that you can bring to the table. What we know, however, is if we put you back on the street with no housing, no employment, and no support mechanism, you will reoffend, right? Under the traditional model, the safest way to do is just put you in prison, right? What we want is we want to figure out, okay, should we put you in prison, or is there somewhere in between that we can address your lack of housing, your lack of employment, your lack of support without going to the other extreme?
Sounds like perhaps a topic for a whole other hour. But yes. Last question for you. How would you define, or how would you like people to define success in your work? I know that prosecutors and DAs often get judged by their, you know, conviction rate and that kind of thing. How would you like your tenure to be defined in terms of success versus failure?
Yeah, I think that one of the most damning things that has occurred to the criminal justice system is the model of assessing the effectiveness of a prosecutor based on their conviction rate. I think conviction rates are important, but that should not be the center point of a DA's work. I think that it's more important that we look at that in conjunction with safety in the community, the sense of safety. What socially responsible actions are you taking? Are you able to keep your community safe at the same time that you're protecting the social fabric of your community and that you're protecting the economic base of your community? You put somebody even in county jail, you're looking at approximately $55,000 a year. You can provide a hell of a lot of services for $55,000 a year to multiple people. So the question becomes, as a prosecutor, how do you achieve that?
And have those metrics been determined yet so that we can actually point to a statistic at some point?
Those metrics will be determined. It's still a little early. We're creating the baby as we move along.
Well, I want to thank our guest this evening, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon. That's our program. Thanks to you and to our listeners for your calls and your comments tonight. For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton, with in-studio support by Wendy and Catherine Holcomb. Join producer and substitute host Victoria Thorpe next Monday as we discuss benefit corporations. For my co-host, David Onick, this is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.